So does the president matter? Last week, the weekend before last, at Bard College, the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities hosted their fifth annual fall conference called Does the President Matter? A Conference on the American Age of Political Disrepair. It was covered by WGXE's Rosalie Elkington, and for those of us who couldn't make it to the conference, Rosalie has given us some excerpts from some of the talks that happened over the course of the 3-day-long conference. So we are going to hear from a couple of folks who spoke there last week. We're going to first return to the site of a panel that took place at the conference. This one was a panel about Occupy Wall Street. It asked the question, is Occupy Wall Street a symptom of an irreparable loss of faith in liberal democracy? I'll say that again. Is Occupy Wall Street a symptom of an irreparable loss of faith in liberal democracy? This, again, framed by the theme of the conference, which is looking at the role of the presidency in politics today and how people perceptions of the presidency and our liberal representative democracy. So we're going to first hear from Speaker Todd Gitlin. He's a professor and chair of the PhD program at the Columbia School of Journalism. He's the author of many books, most recently Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street. Todd Gitlin began his talk at the conference addressing this question by describing two what he called social psychological conditions that allowed for the eruption that was Occupy Wall Street. These were, first, the widespread loss of faith in current institutions, most notably the global economic system, but also the second, some electric hope. Later on, Dr. Gitlin spent some time in his talk exploring the First Amendment right of assembly, which was practiced by Occupy Wall Street participants. Here is Todd Gitlin.
I want to spend a few minutes on the meaning of the assembly. This, to me, is a neglected, both practical, theoretical, and legal aspect of what took place last year. Congress shall make no law regarding the right of the people, I forget the exact language about religion, but there are two clauses about religion, no establishment of religion, and so on. Then the First Amendment continues, shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble, to petition the government for redress of grievances. Now, I've become very interested in this language. There's a long history behind it. Why, since the First Amendment specifies the freedom of speech, why does it need to specify the freedom of assembly? Isn't assembly simply the sum of a lot of acts of speech? No. Freedom of assembly was already an issue before the U.S. Constitution. It is a phrase that appears in state constitutions that were drafted even before there were states. Certainly one of the earliest, if not the earliest, was in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And in the Constitution of Pennsylvania today, as in most of those I've looked at, I have not looked at all of them yet, but in almost all, New York is one of the exceptions. There is freedom of assembly in the New York Constitution. But the clause that comes up in Pennsylvania and in many other states is not in the New York Constitution. And it reads more or less verbatim, the right of the people peaceably to assemble, comma, to consult in the common good. So, this is very interesting. Assembly in this literal originalist, if you will, construction, tells us that assembly is an act of the people. And it is a collective right. It is not exhausted by the sum of all the speeches made on a series of soapboxes. In contemporary law, or I should say in contemporary political practice, this is a wildly radical principle, and it is violated with impunity. It is violated by the mayors of American cities. It was violated in the case of the Occupy movement. And it is violated commonly by police departments who are, of course, in most cases I know of, accountable technically to civilian leadership. So the police, with pepper spray and fences and barricades and nightsticks and mass arrests, have no time for freedom of assembly. Now, I dwell on freedom of assembly not because I think the actual assemblies solve the problems they aspire to address. And much has been written, and I have written some in my book on the movement, and many have written critically or even snidely about the fragility and the fatuousness and the inefficiency and irrationality and time-consuming, time-squandering nature of the assemblies in Zuccotti Park and other places. And I don't for a moment blink that problem. But it seems to me that the problem of the possibility of democracy, the problem, which is to say the problem of the democratic left, is in the relation between critique, or among, critique, ideology, and action. The critique has been essentially that the country and therefore the world economy have been governed by bad values, by values of savage capitalism and stupid capitalism, social Darwinism. The ideology celebrated in the Occupy movement, more or less, preference for anarchist so-called horizontal forms of organization. And there was, and this was the tip-off for the significance of this movement, as it is always the tip-off for the significance of any social movement, a form of action was devised that made sense to its participants and also communicated something promising to outsiders. And so in the case of the Occupy movement, the form of action that evolved was the combination of assemblies and acts of nonviolent civil disobedience.
That was Todd Gitlin from the same panel. We're going to hear Ann Norton. Ann Norton is a professor of political theory at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of many books, including 95 Theses on Politics, Culture, and Method. She started her talk addressing the same question, which again was, is Occupy Wall Street a symptom of an irreparable loss of faith in liberal democracy? She began by saying, if it's not, it should be. That we should question whether liberalism advances or hinders democracy. Here she discusses individual property rights, one of the tenets of economic liberalism.
But the great problem of liberalism is the problem of liberal economics, the problem of property. And this is in some respects a strangely scholarly problem. That for Locke, property meant something quite different. Property meant, first of all, that which was most one's own, the body, your body, the rights it sheltered, the claims that it made, the needs that it had. The body was the center of the rights. And only secondarily did it refer to things, things you held in your hand, things you had mixed your labor with. Yet for liberalism now, property means something different. Property means wealth, goods, or a cipher for wealth and goods, a little entry in a bank that says you have more power than that person has. How does the sacred right to property sound when it means the sacred right to money or the sacred right to my stuff? That, I think, is not a right that can claim any sanctity, and yet that is the right we have. What would happen if we understood the sacred right of property to be concerned with what Locke thought it was concerned with? What if it meant, what if it was concerned with what is properly one's own? With your body, with your mind, with your rights, with your thoughts. What if it conferred the rights the body requires? A right to food, right to shelter, right to health care. What if it conferred the rights that the mind requires, the right to have rights, the right to exercise those rights, the right to education, the right to access to power. Some of the changes that would force would be quite benign changes. policies more sympathetic to universal health care. A little economic redistribution. But some things would be terrifying. We would have to consider what we can actually claim justly to be our own. That's the old question of equality, equality of means. And it's an old question, it's an old struggle, and why is it so hard? And I think it's hard because property has a perverse logic. Those who have are served better by it than those who have not. But those who have the least have the most to lose. If you lose $1 million, you're a billionaire. It's an inconvenience. It's a fluke of the stock market. It's nothing to trouble you. But if you're poor and you lose $1, it's a loss of a meal or what passes for one. If you lose a house, it's not a burden. If you have 6 or 7 like John McCain, you might not even remember where that other house was. But if you lose your house and it's your only house, you can lose a world. So it is the person who has the least, who has the most to lose in losing that sacred right of property. And so those who have an army of have-nots to defend their claims. They profit, as those who have always done, from the labor and the needs and the desperation of those who have not. And it is that perverse logic that I think continues to guarantee, and it's what makes it so very hard to move forward the question of equality.
If you're just tuning in, we are broadcasting some of the excerpts from some of the talks that happened at the Hannah Arendt Center's 5th annual conference. This year it was themed, Does the Presidency Matter? Last week we played the first half of Ralph Nader's keynote speech at the conference, and we left off where he was talking about the expansion of presidential power that we've seen under after President George W. Bush and Obama. We are going to play an excerpt from the second half of his speech now, which we didn't get to air last week. So this is Ralph Nader speaking the weekend before last, near here at Bard College.
Now, on the other hand, you have a president whose hands are tied. Congress reasserts itself, say when the president would want something for health insurance or want something for tax reform or want something for stronger regulation and larger budgets for corporate crime or better social services for poor and the needy, that Congress suddenly reasserts itself and can say no. And very few people have to say no. Think of this absurdity. December 2010, we had an auto safety bill to bring it up to date. It had the president's approval. It had the House approval under Nancy Pelosi. It was going through the Senate under unanimous consent. 99 senators gave unanimous consent. One senator did not. I called the senator up. His name was Senator Coburn from Oklahoma, a medical doctor. I said, what are your objections? Let me respond to your objections. He gave me 3 objections, one of which he doesn't want any bill that spends any more money. I said, this does not spend any more money. It deals with electronics and modern vehicles. It deals in stronger penalties for corporations who violate federal safety standards and so on. That didn't seem to matter. One senator under the rules killed that legislation. How can we not be ashamed of a system like that? And it happens again and again. They hold up judicial appointments. One senator. They hold up legislation. They hold up budgets. They hold up macro budgets for some little itty-bitty thing that one senator doesn't like. And because all the senators want to have the power of that one senator to block action, they will not change the system. They will not change the filibuster. So in that way, the president doesn't matter. The president is blocked by a system that is not democratic and it's not open. A lot of times that one senator who puts a hold, you don't know who that one senator's name is. And it gets worse. When both parties are aggressive, when both parties are warlike, there is no competition from anyone else because there are no third parties. Because third parties are excluded, repressed by the whole system from ballot access to the debates. So you have this paradox that goes on. And the paradox is such that the restraints are still in law, but the powers that can stretch that authority and violate that authority have no political restraint by the people back home. Because the politicians are still afraid of the people. But to be afraid of the people, in a creative sense, the people have to start a rumble. President Nixon signed into law great bills that he never believed in. He signed into law the Occupational Safety and Health Agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Product Safety Commission, the Environmental Protection Council in the White House. And he even wanted other good laws dealing with drug policy, rehabilitation instead of incarceration. He wanted people in the District of Columbia to have the vote for their members of Congress. Now, why would a right-wing Republican senator, Republican president do that? A short answer is he was the last president who's a Republican president who's afraid of liberals. A longer answer is that he heard the rumble from the people. Now, what was that rumble from the people? That rumble from the people was 1% of the citizenry. You heard a lot from Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, about the 1%, the richest, the oligarchs, plutocrats, Wall Street. How about the other 1%? All it takes is 1% of the citizenry rolling up their sleeves, organizing one another in congressional districts, because each under our Constitution by far, you can turn the rest of the government around. All it takes for that level of commitment of a couple thousand people in each congressional district. Every congressional district has colleges and community colleges. Every congressional district has a whole variety of people who are dutiful, sensible, have a sense of their trusteeship to posterity, and want to avoid living a trivial, agonized, frustrating life. But they don't connect with each other. And therefore, they seem to themselves to be powerless. Abraham Lincoln once said, with public sentiment, you can do anything. Without it, you can't do much of anything at all.
Ralph Nader, speaking at Bard College during the fifth annual Hannah Arendt conference called Does the Presidency Matter? This is the closing. This is the closing of his speech.
So let me leave you with this message. Rick mentioned Hannah Arendt's connection between word and deed. There's an ancient Chinese saying, not so ancient, 14th century, to know and not to do is not to know. We got to remember that just having good thoughts and good ideas without applying them raises the very question as to whether we have good thoughts and good ideas. Knowledge for what? Raise your expectation level. You're coming from a generation with an exceedingly low expectation level, and there are a lot of reasons for that, and there's no time to go into. Expectation levels are key to reordering power in a more distributional and just sense. Too much power in too few hands deciding for the many. We have to change that. You change that by a higher expectation level that liberates your sense of indignation, that gives you fire in the belly so it connects with what you know in your mind. You know in your mind what's wrong. You need fire in the belly. The psychologists call it emotional intelligence. Okay, call it emotional intelligence. You need fire in your belly. The great changers in American history, they didn't just know something most people didn't know. They knew something most people knew. Whether it's Rosa Parks or the sit-down strikers in Flint, Michigan, forming the United Auto Workers. They had fire in their belly. Today's generation doesn't have enough fire in the belly. They give you a blank look. Lastly, make the distinction between participants and spectators. Presidential politics has become a spectator sport and is surrounded by theatrics. If it isn't a sport, it's theatrics. There's no reason why we don't invite the presidential candidates to presidential debates all over the country, that we summon the candidates to our cities and towns and rural areas instead of letting a corporation created by the two parties called the Commission on Presidential Debates to decide who gets on and who doesn't and who picks the reporters who ask the questions. What an absurdity. What a mockery. It's allowed because we have such a low expectation level that when you say to people, as we have in recent months in Portland, Oregon, and Pittsburgh, and District Columbia, why don't you put a letter to the presidential candidates with all the citizen groups, business, labor, neighborhoods, nonprofit, civic, women's, children's, and say, we want a presidential debate. You come here. We're going to run it. They look at you like with a blank look. We can do that, you mean? Watch your expectation levels. Finally, get rid of this two-party system, which is the conduit for the corporate state by corporations who have learned to game the system to increase the convergence of the two-party duopoly and turn it into a tyranny and a business agent for fewer and fewer giant corporations who were chartered in the U.S., who grew to profits on the backs of American workers, who when they got in trouble went to Washington and were bailed out on the backs of American taxpayers, who when they got in trouble overseas were able to call on the U.S. Marines to save them. And what is their message to this country, filtered through the two-party duopoly? Is it one of gratitude to the American people? Or is their message, we're out of here, folks, with your jobs and your industries to fascist and communist regimes overseas? Freud liked to talk about guilt. Jung liked to talk about shame. I don't like guilt, but I think it's time that we used shame as a motivating factor. Shame on us. Cognition is not ignition. We got to get that emotional intelligence and expectation level up. Otherwise, whoever becomes president will become a prisoner in the White House of the corporate complex and will matter less and less because we've shaped it that way by making excuses for ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you again to WGXC's Rosalie Elkington for coordinating coverage of the fall conference at the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities. We are going to have another segment just like that on next week's Monday afternoon show. Stay tuned. In a couple minutes, we're going to be joined by Roger Downs, the legislative director of the Sierra Club Atlantic chapter, to talk about the regulatory rulemaking process for natural gas drilling using hydraulic fracturing. That's fracking. It's really important. We all have to understand it. So stay tuned. This is The National.
Your mind is racing like a pronoun. Oh my God, it doesn't mean